We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
And we look to start with this year at 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and 4. We're looking at those because that's where we're up to from the last year. We're going through Corinthians steadily and done three or four sermons on 1 Corinthians chapters 1 and 2. So that's where we're up to. But we're also looking at it because it's a passage about ministry. And that would be a worthwhile topic for us to reflect upon and think about as we start again another year of Christian ministry, of caring for one another, and start our program of meeting consistently and looking to the evangelistic opportunities we have before us as a congregation. So to settle back and to think about the ministry of the gospel and how we relate to each other in that ministry, how we value that ministry, and what is the ministry. The word ministry itself just means service. It's the word service. And so it's very broad in its concept. It does not mean necessarily tied up in a dog collar or anything like that. You don't have to be a clergyman to be a minister. You only have to be a Christian to be a minister. You only have to be one who serves the congregation to be a Christian minister, of course. You can be a non-Christian minister like a prime minister. He is the first servant. That's an interesting and novel approach to the idea of what they think they're doing. But that is what that's what the term is meaning, the minister, the servant. It's an occupational hazard of all those who exercise any leadership that they are evaluated by others around about them. You do it at work too, don't you? Whenever you start to do anything, whenever you seek to do anything, people stand and watch and evaluate, make their judgments and discernments, and all too frequently pass their comments, especially to other people. And it's a character, especially, I suppose, of a society that is built on merit, on achievement. A society where you do what you do because your father did it and your grandfather did and your great-grandfather, well, no one expects you to be any good at it. They just say, well, that's his job in life, that's his task, that's what he was born in. I mean, Prince Charles can't help but be Prince Charles. Whether he's a good prince or bad prince is an irrelevance, he's Prince Charles. But somebody who achieves a particular status, well, we all spend our time evaluating them. And in our society that's all built on merit and achievement, at least that's what we think it is. It's really built on accidents and coincidences. Unless you're a Christian, then you know it's built on God's plans and purposes. But for those of us who think it's on achievement, we love evaluating everybody or each other. And therefore, when it comes to Christian ministry, we do the same thing. It folds into the church itself. When people do things, we say, well, they're good at that, or not as good as that, or better than somebody else at doing that. And we are evaluating, and we particularly love, of course, being Australians, chopping down tall poppies. That's one of the favourite occupational exercises of the whole community. So if anybody ever turns out to be any good at anything in Christian circles, well, immediately everybody's out to demonstrate that they're not as good as they think they are. To the outsider, all forms of Christian ministry turn out to be matters, really, of contempt. The Sunday school teacher is a way of talking about somebody who's simple, naive, an unworldly idiot who hasn't grown up yet. There are quite a few here. That is not, I take it, our evaluation, but yet that is the kind of... She's a kind of a Sunday school teacher girl. You know that in the very expression. It's a put-down, isn't it? It's one who really hasn't seen what life is about yet. One who is too good to be believed. One who is somewhere between sugar and saccharin. The evangelist is somebody who is making money, a smooth talker with the ethics of a used car salesman and a concern for truth of a politician. That's what the evangelist is. You can't believe him, you can't trust him. He's doing tricks, isn't he? He's manipulating crowds, he's using emotions, he's playing upon people's guilt feelings and emotions to achieve an end, and I'm sure he drives a very big car. The minister, I mean the ordained kind of minister, who is the archetypal minister, well, have you ever seen them in any form of play or movie or television where they're anything other than wine bibbers or slow-witted or stupid or immoral or harsh or insensitive or all of the above and a few more. There was that marvellous series that was very, very funny on television some years ago now called All Gas and Gators. It was very funny. I enjoyed it. I would frequently look out for the opportunity of turning it on to have a decent, good laugh. There were always, as in any caricature, of course, great elements of truth. But at the same time, there wasn't one normal human being in the clergy. You may say, well, Philip, if you saw the clergy as we see them... But it's the world's contempt, isn't it, of Christians and all that Christians stand for. They're all like that. And of course, we've recently had the Barchester Towers on television, haven't we? Which does the same kind of series again, where all the clergymen are unpleasant at worst, dills at best. Paul's day, it was the same. The message was held in contempt, and the messengers who bore the message were held in contempt. And chapters 1 and 2 has brought this out to some extent, although we won't go back over it now, to the Greek. What Paul was preaching was foolishness. To the Jew, it was unbelievable. To both of them, it was a matter of scorn and ridicule, as indeed the messengers had become. Look with me to chapter 4, verse, 10 for a while. The apostles... They say, we have become, verse 9, a spectacle to the whole universe, to angels as well as to men. We are fools for Christ. You are so wise in Christ. We are weak. You are so strong. You are honoured, but we are dishonoured. To this very hour we go hungry and thirsty. We're in rags, brutally treated, homeless. We work hard with our own hands. We're cursed when we are cursed, we bless. When we're persecuted, we endure it. When we are slandered, we answer kindly. Up to this moment, we have become the scum of the earth, the refuse of the world. There is the view of the world that Paul was feeling. It's got a certain degree of rhetoric in it as a style, that passage, but it is still the way the world views the true apostles, the scum of the earth, dishonoured, charlatans, tricksters, money grubbers, ridiculous fools, laughable. That's what those who care to stand for Christian ministry are in Paul's day, and I'd suggest to you in our own. Yet, within the church, there is another problem of evaluation, quite radically different. Within the church, not the outsiders' contempt, but there is the temptation to the insiders' idolatry. To those who have found life and forgiveness through the gospel of Jesus and through people ministering that gospel to them, to those who have found meaning and wisdom in life, there is a deep gratitude to the ministers of the gospel who have brought such things to them. To those who are committed to the growth and development of the church, there also can be a desire to support those who minister to them in various ways. Now, all that's okay and right and proper, but it's not hard to see how such commitment to ministers of the gospel can outgrow its right proportion, so that in fact, the ministers of the gospel, instead of actually aiding people in their belief and walk with God, stand in the way of people's walk with God, stand between God and the people. It's very easy for an idolatrous distortion to take place in Christian ministry. That's seen most clearly, of course, when there's party spirit, the following of leaders, such as in Corinth, where Paul is writing here. Some are saying, I follow Paul, verse 4 of chapter 3. I follow Apollos. He spelled out the same kind of thing right back in chapter 1, verse 12. I follow Paul. Another says, I follow Apollos. Another, I follow Cephas. Another, I follow Christ. People are saying, are dividing themselves into parties, but the parties are revolving around certain leaders, certain personalities, certain ministers of the gospel. Now, we're not sure that they were the particular parties in Corinth. Turn with me to chapter 4, verse 6 and take note. Chapter 4, verse 6, he writes, Now, brothers, I've applied these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, so that you may learn from us the meaning of the saying, Do not go beyond what is written, and then you will not take pride in one man over another. I've applied it to Paul and Apollos. The parties may not have been about a Paul and Apollos. They may have been about certain people in Corinth, but rather than name the names, Paul has gone to the names that all Christians knew about, that all the Christians in Corinth knew about, Peter and Paul and Apollos. And he uses these names as saying you can't follow Peter as against Apollos. You can't follow Apollos as against Paul. You can't say, well, I'm just a follower of Christ. And you can't fall into parties like that, as if it revolves around individuals like that. So whether they were the exact parties or whether they were just used as a teaching illustration, here is the example of the insiders' idolatry. They are mere men. They are not Christian at this point. He says, I can't talk to you as Christians at this point. You claim to be so spiritually mature, but you're not like the mature at all if you follow men like that. And yet, of course, it's so easy to do. It's so easy to have your favourite preacher, the person who speaks in such a way that you like it the way he puts it. You follow that one. It's so easy to have his words become ultimately more important than the words of Scripture from which he should be preaching. So that in the end, if he says that's the way it is, well, then that's the way it is, even though it may not be that way. It's out of the mouth of babes and infants that come the praises of God. You cannot institutionalise truth. No one man carries it, and carries it totally and uniquely. We all have different parts of our understandings of the truth that is revealed to us in Christ Jesus, and we can be taught by any, and we can be mistaught by any. We cannot just accept the sayings of Mr. X or Mr. Y, and we cannot be followers of Mr. X or Mr. Y. That can't be right. See, there is an idolatry that has set in. Well, you see it in other forms, don't you? In the pecking order of ministries. There is a pecking order, isn't there? There is a sense in which hardly anybody ever is tempted to clap those who wash up in church. Those who put the books away afterwards. But there are other ministries that I've heard clapped. I've heard no one clamouring to be a cleaner. Or indeed, rarely do you have anybody begging you for the privilege of the ministry of giving their money. Like the Corinthians, like the Macedonians did in 2 Corinthians chapter, where is it, 6? 8, thank you. Wouldn't have hurt them to read chapter 6 though, but it is in 8. No, there's the clamouring to do that. Well, you don't get that very often, do you? Maybe you do. No, there are certain ministries that we think are high status ministries, to which we pay a lot of attention, to which we give lots of credit, and there are others that we seem to just push aside as being of unimportance. And there are certain ways of conducting a ministry which can glamorise the very task, just as there are others that you can do it in such a way that you never draw attention to yourself. You can just let it drop in the circles you're in as to what you're doing, or you can never say a word and do it faithfully. So let's look first at the status of Christian ministry. The status of ministry, so that we will perceive it rightly. We will evaluate ministry correctly. And it's a hard one to hold in your head, this one, because we're going to say two contradictory things, because I believe the Apostle Paul says them here, and they're both true. The status of Christian ministry is twofold. One, it is being a servant, which is, of course, the very nature of the word, as I pointed out earlier. Verse 5 of chapter 3, what after all is Apollos? What is Paul? Only servants, through whom you came to believe, as the Lord has assigned to each his task. I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, God made it grow, so neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow. What is the status of Christian ministry? It's the status of a servant. Now, you don't see servants as being high in dignity, power, prestige, importance. That is not the status of servants in our society or in any society. The servant is the exact antithesis of all those things. The servant is the nothing. The servant is the one who is pushed around, ordered around by everybody. He is the one in whom the boot finally rests, if he doesn't kick the dog, that is. He's down the bottom of the whole scale of things. And Paul says, how are you to view us? You're to view us as servants, as not anything, as only servants. You don't see thousands of people breaking their neck in order to become servants, doing 3 years tertiary education to graduate in order to go out and get their job. You don't see people seeking for their children, praying that they might grow up to be servants. That's not the value system of the world, that it's a high status. It's a low status. It's an only nothing status. And that is the first thing we must grasp about ministry. It's only nothing because it's God who does everything in ministry. It's not anything that we do. One plants, another waters, but it's God who gives the growth. For some years now, Eddie Woodcock and I have been trying to grow trees around their house. Eddie's the man with all the expertise and the trees. And he has been regularly dropping off trees at our place and planting them for us, which is all ever so kind. And I water them. And on about 50% of them, God does not give the growth. Eddie plants all right, plants brilliantly, showing me all kinds of things about planting trees. He can even identify them. He can use the big Latin names as to what kind of trees they are, so surely they must take notice of that. I can go out and call them by their Latin names every morning before breakfast, by their crude, rude Australian name after morning tea. I can water them regularly and consistently, even known to fertilise them under strange, extraordinary circumstances, but their growth rate has got nothing to do with his planting or my watering, because half of them live and half of them die. Can't seem to get any better than that. Because ultimately it's not he who plants that forces them and causes them to grow, or he who waters who forces and causes them to grow, but God in his gracious and mercy who gives the growth. The servant is neither here nor there. It is God who gives the growth. God who is everything in Christian ministry. There are times in which you preach the gospel to people faithfully, accurately, you get the words precisely right, the arguments worked out in detail, everything is absolutely spot on, and the person's not converted. They walk away like the rich young ruler, to your great sorrow. There are other times when you say things that are just offhanded, you don't even get it accurate, and the person hears that phrase and is miraculously converted. Now, I'm not saying, therefore, all evangelism should be offhanded and inaccurate. That's not the point. No, no. I'm saying God works his miracle in the lives of people. He uses us in his kindness and his mercy. And he calls upon us to plant and to water in accordance with the way in which he works in the world, in a right and proper fashion, faithfully and diligently, as we will go on to see in a few minutes. But we mustn't think that our activities are the key. It's God who gives the growth. It is God's work. We are but servants. That's all. Here are two names. Jones and Utzon. Have you ever heard either name? Yes, you've heard both names. But what do you remember about Mr. Jones in particular? William Jones, if you want his name particularly. You don't remember much, do you? What do you remember about Mr. Utzon? Remember anything about him? He designed an opera house, yes. Kind of a little shack down the end of Bennelong Point there. Little weekender. So you can say, he, in a sense, built the opera house. What about Mr. Jones? Oh, he built the opera house too. Worked there for 3 or 4 years, hammering. But you don't remember him, do you? Why? Because he wasn't the one who built it in the grand design and got dismissed. He wasn't that one. He was just one of the servants. Just doing his task. That's all. What is it? You see, God is like the great architect. Excuse me, I'm not giving Masonic language here particularly. I now realise the error of this illustration. God is like a great architect. He is building a great building. It is his building. And he is the one who will be remembered for having built the building. But he is using many servants in the process, many little Bill Joneses down hammering and sawing away under his direction, under his control, under his supervision, but it is his building that he is building. What are the Bill Joneses of this world? They're nothing, really, in this great scheme of things. He is the everything. How do we view our Christian ministry? It's like that. This is God's building, not this building, of course. That's almost as far off as thinking the Masonic way of thinking of God. This is We are God's building, he is saying. You are God's building, verse 9 there. You are God's building. He is building a great building. And as we speak the word of encouragement, as we teach the gospel, as one plants, as one waters, so God's work takes place. God works through that whole process. But those who do it, they are only the servants. It is God who is building the building. It is God's field, God's building. So the first thing about our status is nothing. We've got to grasp hold of that very clearly. Second thing about our status is everything. That's why I said it was a contradiction here. You can't get a lower status than being a minister, because a minister is by definition a nothing. But you can't get a higher status than being a minister of the gospel, because we are God's partners. Each one is doing the work, verse 5, that the Lord has assigned to him. It is the Lord's work we are engaged in. Verse 9, we are God's fellow workers, God's partners. You're God's field, you are God's building, and God is building the building, and we are building the building with him. We are his partners in his work. This is God's work we're engaged in, God's field, God's building. And so as fellow workers with God, we water and we plant and God gives the growth, because we're all working on the same project with the same purpose. Verse 8, the man who plants, the man who waters have one purpose. The purpose has got to do with God's purpose. We are working together with God. That little phrase, God's fellow worker, comes up 3 to 4 times in the New Testament. It's in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 1, where again Paul sees himself as that, or in 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 2, where he calls Timothy God's fellow worker. It puts our status on a very high plane. For God is a working God. God is working at his purposes, which we'll see in a few moments, and we are called upon to engage in them. If you're to say that you're a partner in a law firm, partner in an accountancy firm, in an architecture firm, the big $64,000 question is, partner of whom? Who are the partners in this firm that you're in? Are you the senior partner? Well, then we know what kind of legal firm that is. It's a nothing firm, given you're the senior partner. But are you in one of those firms where there are 50 or 60 senior partners above you, including some of the greatest names in the whole field? And you're one of their partners. Well, that makes you someone, doesn't it? It's with whom you're in partnership that can really stand you up as important. Who's your partner? If you're engaged in any Christian ministry, God is your partner. Let me try and illustrate it from my life for a moment. Because this year, I am sharing platform twice with great ones. Down the AFES conference, John Stott was speaking at that same conference, and those who have been in Christian circles for any length of time and read any Christian books and have ever heard Christian preachers say, John Stott is one of the greatest preachers in the world today, one of the great Christian leaders in the world today. You are speaking on the same platform as John Stott. In June this year, I'm going to England to speak at a conference where Jim Packer is the other speaker, the two principal speakers of this international conference, Philip Jensen and Jim Packer, in alphabetical order. So there you see. People say, you have hit the big time. You are speaking on the same platform as Jim Packer, as John Stott. Rubbish. I've been on a bigger platform for that in years. I'm on the same platform as God. What's John Stott? Jim Packer. Nothing. Forget it. You see, our unworldliness creeps in, doesn't it? Very easy. Of course, many of my friends, some of you, to your embarrassment now, some of you have said, boy, what a thing, and you ribbed me about it, and that's all right. And it's very easy to feel that, and you think you've arrived now. But you can't actually be on an equal working relationship with anyone like God. But if you're a Christian involved in any Christian ministry, that is who is your partner. And so, there is no one greater than those involved in Christian ministry. Isn't that extraordinary to put those two ideas together in verses 5 through to 9 that I've been dealing with there? At one level, only a servant, not anything. At another level, God's partners, God's fellow workers in God's great enterprise. Well, let's turn to this teamwork with God, because the chapter is about this teamwork with God. If we're going to be God's partners, what's the business enterprise that God's in? Well, it changes in verses 5 to 9. It's talking about God as an agriculturalist, so planting and watering. But the metaphor changes from verse 9 onwards to the metaphor of building, because it suits his purpose better. The building metaphor. God is at work in building a building. Now, God is at work in the world in lots of ways. He sends the sun, which he did with a vengeance today, didn't he? And he sends the rain, and we've been hanging out waiting for it most of the day. But if you remember how much this roof leaks in this building, pray that a little while later before it starts. He sends rain. That's not the great enterprise of God in the world, though. That's just his standard work. He's been just running along that one ever since the creation. No. He has got a big work, a special work that he is engaged in. And that big and special work is to build a people of God. From every tribe and every nation and every peoples of the world, every language group of the world, God's aim is to build a new nation of his people. His people who will acknowledge the lordship of Jesus. Now, there are certain passages of the Bible that you could turn to grasp this grand scheme. Revelation chapters 4, 5 and 6 is a marvellous one that I've been using for the last couple of years, and did a mid-year conference talk on it last July, and so I'm sure there's a tape up there somewhere about it. Joe's just dying because there isn't a tape up there about it. There's one, and Joe can get it in. If you've never heard Revelation 4, 5 and 6 and what the book of Revelation's about, that's a good place to start. It shows God's grand scheme in the world. But there are others, like Ephesians 1, verses 3 to 10. That's such a magnificent passage. We did a six-week series on that one. It's also up in the tape library, I trust and hope. As it spells out God's plan from before the creation of the world up until the end time. God is not kind of standing back and working like a washerwoman. Every time someone slips and spills something, he comes in with a mop and cleans it up, and then he stands back and waits for another slip, and he comes in and cleans that one up, and then he stands back and waits for another slip, and comes in and... God's not like that. He's not responding to us all the time. God is initiating. God has a plan and a purpose for the universe. And the ultimate part of that plan is to acknowledge Jesus Christ as Lord over a whole new people. And he is gathering in this new people through the proclamation of the gospel. You see it again in Romans 8, 28 to 30. Romans 8, 28 to 30. That God is at work in everything to bring us into Christ-likeness of character. And you see it here in this passage, that God is building a temple. A living temple, not a stone temple. God is not interested in stone temples. He's interested in a living temple made up of humans, made up of his people who will sing his praises and declare his glory by their very being as much as by their actions. And so in verse 9, let's just look through it in this passage here. Verse 9, we are God's building. Verse 10, by the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder. Someone else is building on it. But each one should be careful how he builds on this building. Look over to verses 16, 17. Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's Spirit lives in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him, for God's temple is sacred and you are that temple. Here's the temple of God. The people of God are the temple of God. And God is building his temple stone by stone, person by person. And he is building it in holiness, and he is building it numerically, and he is building it in Christ-likeness of character. So that ultimately when we get to heaven, there won't be a physical temple, because God will be with his people. God will dwell with us, as God does now dwell with us, by his Spirit. And so God's Spirit, verse 16, lives in us. He dwells amongst us. And so, verse 21, so then, no more boasting about men. Because all things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or the present or the future, all are yours and you are of Christ and Christ is God's. Everything ultimately is God's and he gives all to Christ who gives it all to his people. So all is ours because the very purpose of God throughout the whole universe and the whole of history is to build this people. Here is God's special work, which we'll look at more in the coming week. What is our participation? We can work the work of the Lord when we participate in this building operation, as we share in bringing people the great news of Jesus Christ, as we plant, as we water, as we minister, as we encourage, as we build up fellow believers, so we are participating in God's great task. But how do we do it? Well, there are three V's I've given you here. Sorry about the alliteration. Firstly, it's varied in ministry. And that's one of the themes that he is making, that people are doing different things. One waters, one plants. But they're doing the same thing. They're seeking for the growth of the plant. One may be putting in the carpentry, another putting in the plumbing, but they are ultimately trying to do the same thing, building the building. It's the same ultimate goal, though it may be varied. Now, because the problem seems to be in Corinth that there are particular persons, the kinds of ministries that are spoken of here are fairly limited. The Apollos kind of ministry, the Cephas kind of ministry. We would have to go elsewhere in the New Testament or elsewhere even in Corinthians to find out that every Christian is a minister. It's not stated here, but it is clearly taught in the rest of the scriptures and even later in this epistle to the Corinthians. And so the variety of ministries is enormous. There are certain ministries like preaching the gospel, which are very central to the purposes of God. There are others, and will always be central to the purposes of God. There are others like doing the washing up, which may or may not be central to the purposes of God. Depends whose washing up you're doing when, and why, and how. Oh, you can do, see, non-Christians can do the washing up in a way that they can't really pray. That's a very central one, isn't it? You can't really be evangelizing. That's really a very central one. But you can be washing up in order to aid and assistance the evangelization of the world, can't you? In order to help people in their prayer meeting. So there's almost no limit to the number of things. I pick washing up as one of the most menial in our world's terms and one of the most fundamental things of life. There's nothing that you can do that couldn't be used of service in the building up of God's people. The variety is enormous. Ponder for a moment your outlines, these pink outlines that we give out. You see, somebody has designed it. Somebody has written it, worked it out. Somebody has typed it up. Somebody has printed it off. Somebody has folded it. Somebody has brought it to church, and somebody else has handed it to you. There's an enormous number of people involved in the production of this little piece of paper that comes into your hand, which you just take for granted as you walk in and write little notes to each other. No, and write your sermon notes on carefully and diligently, I trust. Now, is any one of those people more important than any other one? No, of course not. If anyone fails in a particular week to do their task, the thing doesn't get here, does it? The bloke who's supposed to bring it here doesn't bring it here, well then it may be typed and it may be accurate in its presentation, but it's no use. If the person who does the photocopying actually doesn't photocopy, you just hand it blank pieces of paper. If the person preparing it doesn't prepare it, as has been known on occasions, then again it's just a blank piece of paper that comes to your hand. Or if the person at the door doesn't actually hand them out to people, or even only picks every second person, again, it doesn't fulfil its purpose. All those different jobs are all part of ultimately the same purpose, aren't they? And they're all needed to fulfil the function, the aim, the goal. It's all there. It's all part and parcel of the same team they're playing on. And they're all needed. And so within Christian ministry, there are enormous number of things that people can be doing. Cleaning, folding paper, typing, handing out, taping, amplifying. So I always think, by the way, in those rock groups these days, that the man who really plays the music is the man on the mixer box. He can bring in and drop out any person up on the stage he likes or doesn't like, as the case may be. He is the only person who is actually in control. I thought I'd say this, lest somebody over there be tempted to drop me out at this moment. Just let me pay homage to those who control me. No. There's varieties of things that are involved, isn't there? It's not just ministries too, which are labelled. Here is the official hander-outer of sheets. That's not the person with the ministry of handing out the sheets. It's anybody who does it. Here is the official person of encouragement. No, it's anybody who encourages. Anybody who does the task, it's a doing thing. It's not so much a status, role, title thing. Whoever does the job is the person who ministers the word, ministers the encouragement, ministers the gospel, builds the people. Now, at this point, of course, it's particularly important that we draw attention to our prayer and Bible groups, of which we've got the lists up tonight that we're starting up. Because it's within that context, in particular in our congregation, that each and every member has the opportunity of encouraging and ministering to a small group of other believers, 10 or so believers in each of the groups, praying for each other, encouraging each other, listening to each other as we talk about our problems, reading the Bible with each other, being concerned for each other, writing letters to each other, keeping track of each other as we travel or go on our holidays. There are an enormous number of ways in which, through those meetings, those regular weekly meetings and the interactions that take place outside of them as well, we actually minister to each other and build each other up in godliness and holiness, and teach each other the gospel and what it means, and exemplify it to each other in the way in which we live close enough to be seen by each other. It's a marvellous ministry, and every member is involved in that ministry. And no one has a title. No one has a job description. That's not what it's about. It's about building. And there's an enormous variety. One of our dear friends, who may be here, so I won't mention him, has a tremendous ministry of writing letters. He writes some of the nicest letters. He's not always very articulate when you meet him face to face, but when you get pen in paper, he really writes marvellous letters of encouragement. Quite unexpected, out of the blue kinds of letters. I mean, it's one thing to get Chrissy cards, it's another thing to get birthday cards, but we know they're not really sincere, they're just expecting one back. But this bloke writes kind of like inter-birthday cards and inter-Christmas cards, you know, little words of encouragement and greeting when there's no reason at all, which can only mean that he has genuinely been thinking about you and genuinely been praying for you, and is genuinely concerned for you. And you say, yes, isn't it wonderful that God does work in creating love in the hearts of people? The ministries are enormously varied. And secondly, you'll notice how they're valued. They're valued all the same. Be it the planter, be it the water, it is exactly the same. They're valued as servants and therefore nothing, and as God's fellow workers and therefore everything. If you are doing what you are doing in order to build the temple of God, then you are God's fellow worker, a servant of his people. We proclaim, says Paul in 2 Corinthians 4:6, we proclaim Christ as Lord and ourselves as your servants. Marvellous ministry that is available to us all. And so we're all the same, for we have all the same purpose. All are needed, all are equally valued. The consequence of it, as you think it out, of course, is enormous for the way in which we relate to each other. For there cannot now be a pecking order within the congregational life, can there? That's not part of Christian fellowship. That is part of the way the world thinks, which we must keep out of our congregational life. Is it not so easy to think that there are some people in the church who are the heavies? Not talking about their anatomies. Right. Just hold myself in for a minute here. Hold my trousers at the same time. It's not talking about there are some people who are the heavies. There are some people who are obviously in the inner in group. There are those, and I've even had people come and say they've marked them out because they're the ones who get up on the platform and read the Bible or lead in prayer. You've got to be a real in-group person to be able to ever invited to do that. If you knew the process by which we selected people to read the Bible and lead in prayer, you'd know how absolutely ludicrous that is. But from outside, and from outside the way the world views things normally, then surely those who are called upon to do that must be the people who really are the in-group. Because that's worldly thinking again. And peaked with it is our own jealousy, and our own envy, and our own desire to be accepted. And if they asked me to do that, then I know I would be a member. I really would be a member. Rather than knowing you're a member because you've been forgiven through the death of Jesus. We all come in on the same basis. Forgiveness. That's how we come in the name of Jesus. Not on the basis of what we can do. Or haven't we seen it also in churches where someone has been converted, especially this happens with youth work, where someone is converted who is athletic and intelligent and good-looking. It happened to me in my youth. And immediately, because of these very marvellous characteristics, they are pressed into being the fellowship leader. Their own growth in spirituality, their grasp of the gospel, their ability to be able to teach it to anybody else is not considered. It's the way the world views him. It's the way the world views her. They say, oh, this person has got it. It's not godliness. Now, worldly perception is a very serious error here. Let me pick on the vindicated one before we come further onto that viewed properly. Thirdly, our work in the end will be vindicated, for on the last day, all will be revealed for what it is. If we've built with poor materials, our work will be destroyed. It won't last. It won't stand the test. But if we have built properly, our contribution to the temple will be seen for what it is in the last day and will be blessed by God. For our labour will not be in vain. You see it there in verses 11 and 12, where Paul says, I've laid the foundation on Jesus. Now don't lay on any other foundation, because you won't be building God's temple if you're laying on another foundation. Make sure you go to the right site if you're going to be a bricklayer. Turn up to the right site, because if you'll turn up to the wrong site and build on the wrong foundations, you're not going to get anywhere. Jesus is the right foundation stone, and you watch out how you build, the quality with which you build, because on the day, verse 13, it will all be brought to light. It'll be revealed. The secret hearts and motivations will all be tested and shown and proved. And if the building is of such character of weakness, it'll be burned up as if you suffer loss. Although we're not talking about a person's salvation in this passage. It's got nothing to do with salvation or purgatory. It's got to do with your life's work in building God's people. It will be seen. See, if you set out to be a great preacher in order to gain the kudos and the fame and the world tours and the trips, then on the last day that will be seen. Or in this day it may not be seen. In this day everyone will say, oh, he's a great preacher. But on the last day the secrets of our hearts will be revealed. And the work that we have been doing will be seen for what it was, ego tripping. And must be destroyed with all forms of ungodliness. But if we work, whatever it may be, privately, quietly, without anyone knowing, praying for people regularly and consistently, labouring over them in prayer, then on the last day it'll be seen. The great reward will take place, as you will see on that last day in ways you never expected, how God was answering your prayers, and in response to your prayers, this has happened, and that, and this, and that. A friend of mine's a clergyman who met up with a mutual friend and said his name was, and I'll have to change names here so no one will be able to work it all out, Fred Smith. I don't think I know a Reverend Fred Smith. And the Reverend Fred Smith met Bill Jones. We'll get him out of the Opera House building now. And he said, Bill said to him, Fred, were you a teacher up at Mungandai? And Fred said, yeah, I was. He said, really? And he said, did you know X? Fred said, yeah, I know X well. He said, oh, that's marvellous. He said, I've been praying for you because when you were teaching at Mungandai school there with Mr. X, Mr. X told me that you were interested in the gospel and asked us to pray for you, and I've been praying for you for the last 10 years, but I never heard whether you got converted or not. But I've kept praying for you. Now, there is an interesting form of faithfulness, isn't it? You want to get on that bloke's prayer list, don't you? He is the man to get on the prayer list of. I've commended myself to him many times by showing my ungodliness in front of him, lest he want to drop me off his prayer list as thinking I'm needing any more. No, see, there is a man. But not even he himself knew what had taken place in the work that he was doing, in the ministry of the gospel he was doing. But on the last day, it'll all become apparent. We'll all know. And your work in the Lord will never be in vain. So what of our ministries? Well, Paul is concerned that the ministries were not being viewed properly. Some have come after him and divided his work, puffed up with their own importance. It's always a danger of ministries within a church That's the way the world thinks, and he's saying, you are still worldly, and I don't want to treat you as worldly. I want you to think spiritually about being in church and in ministry. We know elsewhere that we're all caught up in this ministry, so how do we view our ministries? Let me suggest to you there are two errors. One, we think too highly of ministries. And two, you can guess, we think too lowly. We think too highly when we're put out, if we haven't been invited to be the youth leader or the Sunday school teacher or the leader of this study or that or the beach mission team member or whatever it is. We think too highly when we're only willing to do important tasks. When we've peaked a little bit, that they ask us consistently and continually to do what seem to be menial tasks. We think too highly when we think it's important that we have the task and the official invitation. But it's not our job if we haven't been invited to do it. We think too highly of ourselves and of ministry. We've got it all wrong when we think like that, when there is a role, when there is a title. One of our friends who I can now mention because he's left us is James Davidson. He's now in college. When James came here, he immediately commended himself to me because on the second Sunday he was here, Sunday morning, I saw him picking up the books over morning tea and stacking them away. And I said, who on earth is that man? Never clapped eyes on him before, because I didn't know it was his second Sunday. Never clapped eyes on him before, and he's already going around doing what is seemingly the most menial of tasks, picking up books and putting them away. Why do I want to know who that man is? Because I think he's nicking books? No. Because any man who's willing to do that is a man who's got no pride, who's not standing on ceremony, who doesn't think I have to be asked officially to do that which is obviously kind and caring. Any man who's like that has the mentality of a servant, who's committed to the service of God's people, isn't he? Very, very endearing charm in that man, that he thinks so little of himself, but rather preening. If you're here for the second time, I'm not actually giving you a hint, although it won't do you any harm. I won't be looking, though. We also, when we have too narrow a view of ministries, we don't broaden out and see the varieties of ways in which we can help. We think we only can minister if we're ordained. We can only minister if we're a preacher. We can only minister. It's anything that contributes to the building up of God's people, to the assistance of the preaching of his word and the teaching of his gospel. We think too highly of ourselves when we fail to see the important privilege we have of things like prayer and Bible groups. We go along just thinking about them in terms of what can they give me and do I enjoy it, rather than seeing that here is this enormous privilege of being close enough to people to pray with them about their lives, share with them in the Bible and the things of God, encourage them and live with them through the decisions of the next 12 months, just as a member, for all members minister. We think too high, so that's all thinking too highly of the ministry. You see, we've got the wrong views of it. So think too lowly is the other end of it, though, isn't it? I think I used the word lowly and highly incorrectly there. We think too lowly of ministries when we think that what we do in church is just totally unimportant. Here is the contempt of the world. When we think Sunday school teaching is like a hobby that you grow out of someday. When you think that your real life's work is out in the world, in the profession, in your sport, in your career, in your self-development, in your self-fulfillment, that teaching Sunday school is not nearly as important as being the top executive of your firm. When you think that putting out books is nothing. When you think that teaching Sunday school is nothing. Preaching the gospel is nothing. Here is the problem, isn't it? We have to think spiritually. There is nothing that you and I will do at any time in any week that is ever more important than building the temple of God. Never do anything that's more important than that. It may be the small thing of a word of encouragement to a little child who's coming in the Christian community. It may be the sharing of the gospel to someone and seeing them led to Christ. It may be just helping the Christian meeting order itself more seemingly in helping with the parking. But if what you are doing is that work, then it is God's work. And then there is nothing that you do that's ever as important as that. Therefore, how should we do it? But diligently. Notice how Paul says, no one can lay a foundation other than the one already laid, and if any man builds on his foundation, whoops, I've got it. End of verse 10 it is, each one should be careful how he builds. Quality workmanship. There was a quaint thing that took place in the building of these pews that my old carpenter friends tell me that there was a tradition which saw that things that actually went into the church buildings always had to be done to the top quality. We'd call it these days export quality because we were more interested in making money than doing architectural glorification tricks. And so church buildings have got quality furniture which is quite out of keeping with their comfort, as you now know too well. And that's why part of the reason why, of course, trendy people like to buy up church pews to hang around in their back gardens and their patios, because they're such good quality materials have gone into them, etc. Now, it's a wrong view of the temple, because it says this building is the temple of God, and the building isn't. But it's a right view of saying, if what I am doing is the work of the Lord, then second-class quality is not good enough. Can't be. How could it possibly be good enough to be second class? How could you possibly say, I'm doing this for God and she'll do? It's not possible. So if you're a Sunday school teacher, there is nothing that you do that is more important in a week than teach your Sunday school class. And therefore the quality of the work in your Sunday school teaching should be top. No point being slap happy about it. No point being unprepared. It's got to actually be first class, because this is the most important thing you do all week. The world will hold you in contempt. The people of God should pray for you.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.